Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. We have an absolutely brilliant episode for you today. We're travelling back 1,000 years with one of the world's favourite historical novelists. 31 years ago, a long and curious historical novel was published called The Pillars of the Earth. The book revolved around an intoxicating dream, the ambition of a community to build a magnificent cathedral. The book was set in the 12th century and it had a vibrant cast of characters. There was the mason Tom Builder, Aliena, Jack, William Hamley. Perhaps some of these names will be familiar to you already, but they really caught the imagination of a generation. The book was bought by the million. The Pillars of the Earth came to define the idea of an epic, and it is now established as a masterpiece of narrative writing. We're very fortunate and very excited that the author of that book, Ken Follett, is our guest today on Travels Through Time. The writer of novels like The Eye of the Needle and World Without End, Ken's career has yielded many number one and international bestsellers. He's now back with one of the most anticipated books imaginable. It's a prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. It's set in that same southern English landscape and it's set at the turn of the last millennium. The book is called The Evening and the Morning. Thanks to Ken's publishers, we have a couple of first edition hardback copies of The Evening and the Morning to give away to Travels Through Time listeners. To be in with a chance of winning one, all you have to do is head to our website, tttpodcast.com, and sign up for our newsletter. But first of all, I hope you'll join me and Ken on a tour back into the past. As ever, I gave him the chance to travel back to a specific year and to explore it in three telling scenes. Welcome to the podcast, Ken. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
I'm very glad to be here.
Right. Today we're going to spend a bit of time talking about your new book, The Evening and the Morning, which is a wonderful new novel that I've been engrossed in over the last few days. And we're going to do that through the prism, as ever, the Travels Through Time format, where we go back in time. But first of all, I wanted to ask you a few introductory questions. So right at the start of The Evening and the Morning, you have a lovely, poised introductory piece. You write, "When the Roman Empire declined, Britain went backwards. As the Roman villas crumbled, the people built one-room wooden dwellings without chimneys. The technology of Roman pottery, important for storing food, was mostly lost. Literacy declined. This period is sometimes called the Dark Ages, and progress was painfully slow for 500 years. Then, at last, things started to change. Is this the fundamental attraction of the time, that it's the beginning of something magnificent and something new?"
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I always look for moments in history that I can see as turning points. And I think this was round about the year 1000, was the moment when people, as it were, looked up from the mud and slime of the Dark Ages and began to have new aspirations. Of course, they didn't fulfill their aspirations. One of the themes of The Evening and the Morning is the law and who it serves and who's subject to the law. In the 11th century, no country in Europe had what we now call the rule of law, but people began to aspire to it. And those aspirations then created conflicts. And that's the kind of thing that is great for me to make a story out of.
Yeah, this is a sense of something which came through in The Pillars of the Earth. I remember reading that many years ago, but even more so now, that one of the great actual Ken Follett characters, I think, is the outlaw, who's often about to jump out of some ditch in the middle of a forest and take people by surprise. And in a way, that shows, I think, this idea about law that you're talking about, that there were, you know, kind of ideas about morality that were forming, but they hadn't always been codified. And people were very vulnerable, weren't they?
Yes, indeed. And of course, danger had a different connotation before the modern period, because things like injury, which today would be dealt with and people would recover from, were often fatal. So, for example, if your child fell out of a tree and broke his leg, you'd probably die. Today, if your child fell out of a tree and broke his leg, you'd be terribly upset and you'd call an ambulance. But the child would almost certainly be okay in the end, would make a full recovery. And this kind of thing just didn't happen in the Middle Ages, even in the Victorian period. Injuries which we now consider not to be fatal were fatal. So it's not just the outlaws, it's also the fact that getting better after any kind of violence was pretty unlikely.
So there's this sense of people living on the edge, and I suppose that just makes life all the more vivid. The novel itself spans a decade, which is 997 to 1007. I don't quite know the best format of saying that, 1007. I imagine that if you asked even a pretty well-read person to name an event that happened within this span of years, you know, someone on the street or in the butcher's queue, they'd be pretty hard pressed to give you an answer. With so little known for sure, whereabouts did you go to research this novel?
There are a few Anglo-Saxon buildings left in England, and I think I've visited them all. Much more common is a fragment of an Anglo-Saxon building that still exists within a more modern, a more recent structure. So there are lots of medieval churches that have bits of Anglo-Saxon masonry in them. But by and large, the Anglo-Saxons built very, very little in stone. Their houses were made of wood. All their buildings were made of wood. There were no castles at all in Anglo-Saxon England. They did not write very much down. There are quite a lot of contracts having to do with land being sold or gifted, but very little else was written down. And there weren't many pictures. There was not much painting and drawing at the time. The one thing we have got, which is enormously helpful, is embroidery. Embroidery seems to have been one of the two great art forms of Anglo-Saxon England. Embroidery was one, jewellery was the other. And of course, we have one marvellous historical document in the Bayeux Tapestry, which is technically not a tapestry, it's a work of embroidery. And that really is the most important piece of evidence about what life was like in the 11th century. You'll know, Peter, that it's the mother of all strip cartoons. Mm-hmm. And it tells the story of the Norman conquest of England, but it also, as it were, accidentally gives us all kinds of little details about everyday life in England and Normandy at the time, things that just don't appear in anything written down. For example, one of the panels shows a group of men having dinner, which enables us to see their cutlery and the food they ate and their drinking vessels. We also see their servants and we see people cooking. This kind of thing is gold dust. We might wonder how people boarded ships in the 11th century when there basically weren't any jetties and docks. And we see in one of the panels of the Bayeux Tapestry, we see that what people did was they hitched up the skirts of their tunics and waded through the water to get to the boats. That's how you boarded a ship. It's rather charming, actually, because one of the characters in the tapestry is wading through the shallows to get to his boat, and he's carrying his dog in his arms, which I think is rather a charming, funny thing. Dogs can swim, of course. So this must have been a rather precious dog to actually have been carried onto the ship. Anyway, that's the kind of little detail that we get in the Bayeux Tapestry that is tremendously helpful.
Yeah, the ones that I've picked up from reading through is when you mentioned that the English had moustaches but no beards, which was a kind of a subtle...
Isn't that funny?
Isn't that funny?
I mean, that also is directly from the Bayeux Tapestry, because you can tell the Normans from the English in the Bayeux Tapestry, the Normans have this really silly haircut. Their hair is shaved at the back all the way up to the crown of the head. Looks very funny and it's very distinctive. And the English don't have that, but they all have these little pencil moustaches, which, I mean, they're probably pencil moustaches because they're done with one stitch of wool, you know.
Right, okay.
They may have had, you know, people didn't shave very often in the Dark Ages. I don't believe people had carefully trimmed moustaches, but I think that's the pencil moustache is a consequence of the fact that it's depicted by a piece of wool sewn onto a piece of linen.
Yeah, I think you have some good fun as well with Edgar, your character, who you have as washing once a year, which is another little peek into cleanliness of the period. But I think my favourite of all the details, I had to mention this because it put a smile on my face, is when you are talking about Dreg's Ferry, I think, your little hamlet.
Yes.
Is that right?
And, yes, Dreng's Ferry.
Dreng's Ferry, of course. And there's a lady there who's got a cheese safe. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. You know, if there's one thing that John Lewis should sell nowadays, it's a cheese safe. Now, I don't know. How can we talk about evolution if in 1,000 years we've lost that? But again, it's a nice little detail, which I think shows you a kind of surprising feature of life at that time. Anyway, let's have all this as a bit of build-up. That works for a setup. And now I want to ask you, Ken Follett, the question we ask of all of our guests that come on this podcast. If you could travel back through time to a specific year, what year would you choose?
I would go to the year 1002.
Right.
And this is largely as a result of my having written The Evening and the Morning, because there were so many things that I couldn't check while I was writing The Evening and the Morning. We've talked a little already, Peter, about some of the little details that I found in the research, but there were many things that I couldn't figure out, many things that just nobody knows, I had to guess at, and I'm still wondering about. It's partly that the curiosity that has been aroused in me by not being able to discover certain bits of information, certain things about this period of time, things that I would have liked to know while I was writing The Evening and the Morning, and I wasn't able to find out.
Are these things that you mention here, are they the small social thing, or, you know, matter of life, as we were talking about little moments then? Or do they relate more to bigger events like geopolitics or dynastic warring and feuds?
It's mainly the little things. It's mainly the little things. I'll give you an example. Underwear. Mm. Nobody knows what underwear the Anglo-Saxons wore. Not something that's ever been written about. It's not depicted in any kind of drawing, paintings, drawings, illustrations. As a historical novelist, basically, if I do everything I can to find out the truth and it proves elusive, then I have to make something up. And so I still don't know what kind of underwear people wore in the 11th century.
Well, on its own, that justifies this whole time travel, I think, just to work out the underwear. But could you?
It could be a bit embarrassing, Peter. I have to go around lifting people's skirts.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure what the morality of the time was in relation to that. But what I also wanted is, can you just give us a general picture of the world as it was 1,000 years ago in 1002, which obviously is a time so distant to us, but if we're talking about the south of England, which is, I suppose, the primary focus of the novel, I know you go backwards and forwards between France as well, but could you just give us a bit of a picture of what was happening from a kind of eagle-eye view?
First of all, the eagle's eye would notice that it was a thinly populated place, even by comparison with the Middle Ages, never mind the 21st century. The main landscape would have been small villages and hamlets surrounded by cultivated fields and woodland. There were cities, of course, but you would hardly have recognised them because the city would consist of a few hundred wooden huts with thatched roofs. There were no roads, no paved roads at all. And if you saw people travelling, which they did not do very much, but if you saw people travelling, they would be walking or riding small horses along tracks through the woods and between the fields. There would have been activity on the rivers. The rivers were important. You would have noticed quite a lot of water mills and some fish ponds. A few bridges, not that many. Basically, the landscape would not be all that much affected by human beings.
Okie dokie. Well, let's go exploring this world a little bit. We're going to do this, as ever, by going to three scenes which we can look at imaginatively and analytically. And the first one, well, I'll ask you, where would you like to go first?
I'd like to go to the slave market in Bristol.
Well, this seems tremendously topical at the moment because I think everyone who's listening to this will have seen the pictures of the slave trader Edward Colson's statue being thrown into Bristol Harbour. They went round the world and we instantly think of the Atlantic slave trade and all the horrors of the Middle Passage.
Yes, I mean, people who don't know very much history think that slavery was invented by the 16th century English seafarers. And that, of course, is completely wrong. Slavery is actually a pretty much normal part of human civilization. It's existed in most eras, and it was very strong in England. The Domesday Book is our key reference here. Listeners may know that the Domesday Book is a sort of inventory that the Normans made of England once they had conquered it, a book that would tell them everything that they owned. And of course, it mentions slaves. And the calculation made on the basis of the Domesday Book is that 10% of the population of England were slaves. It's a very high number. It means it's basically a slave-owning society. People lose sight of this partly because we think of slavery, as you've said, in connection with the Atlantic slave trade. It's partly because Anglo-Saxon historians are a little bit bashful about this. Most people who study the Anglo-Saxon era would like to think well of it. They would like to think that it wasn't a sort of law of the jungle, brutal, horrible society. They point to the strong elements in Anglo-Saxon civilization, and they're a little bit embarrassed by the slavery. And they're inclined to say, one of my advisors for the evening in the morning said to me, well, yes, there were slaves, but you know, it wasn't really that bad. And I just don't believe that. I don't believe slavery was ever not really that bad. Slavery is horrible and terrible, and I suspect it always was. That's part of the reason why we don't hear much about slaves in Anglo-Saxon England, because the historians play it down. But, you know, 10% of the population, those slaves must have done a great deal of the housework, a good deal of the heavy labour in the fields. They probably did a great deal of the unpleasant work, the shovelling of manure and that sort of thing. I'm afraid they would, both males and females, would have been prostitutes. That would be why, I mean, everybody knows that all slave traders, their preferred prey, as it were, is adolescent boys and girls. And that's because they are the most valuable as prostitutes. So it's a very grim aspect of Anglo-Saxon England, but I think it's one that must be confronted.
And you have pinpointed Bristol as the place where there was a particular slave market. And so that begs a question. Well, it begs a few questions, I think. First of all, what kind of place was Bristol at this time? And was it a likely location for a slave market, or was it just a typical town where there's a slave market and there might be any number the same?
It was a likely location because it was a seafaring town. The slave trade was, as best we can make out, the slave trade was mostly run by the Vikings. And they had three large slave markets. And they were in Bristol, Dublin and Rouen, all port cities. And that would have been essential because the Vikings would raid, as everybody knows. They raided coastal towns and villages, and they also sailed up river when they could to raid cities and towns that were river ports. And one of the things that they stole was people. And they would capture people and load them onto their boats, and then they would take them to a slave market where they would be sold. So it's clearly the best place to have your slave market is in a place that is already a thriving port city with all the facilities, all the docking facilities and so on that go along with that. So yes, Bristol is absolutely a good place to have a slave market.
And is it by this time already a substantial settlement?
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure about that. I think it must have been, but I have never read a description of Bristol in the 11th century, and I'm not sure that very much is known about it other than that there was a big slave market.
Okay, and so to go there at this moment in 1002, you said before your primary motivation for this travel was to kind of find out the little details. So would it be really to observe the modes of exchange, the,
yes,
you know, the kind of, I suppose, the whole, what should we say, the whole panorama of life that was going on in the slave market, which is probably lost to us today?
Yes, I would like to know the subtleties of pricing, for example. Were females more expensive or cheaper than men? What about, as opposed to adolescents, what about children? I would have liked to know what, if anything, happened to families. Was it ever possible for people who had been part of a family, who had been a family together before they were captured, was it ever possible for them to stay together? Would we see in this slave market those harrowing scenes of children being taken away from parents and so on? And I'd like to know more about what the buyers were, who the buyers were, what they were looking for, and was it all about strength? If you were buying a slave to work in the house, did you want somebody who didn't look too tough? Somebody who looked as if they didn't make trouble, that sort of thing. I would have loved to be able to go into that sort of thing in a bit more detail in the evening and the morning, but the information just isn't available. And so what I, you know, what I did of that kind of thinking is guesswork.
Yeah, it's absolutely the kind of scene that would attract a novelist. I can see that immediately. And slavery as a theme is something which is embedded at the, you know, kind of centre of your book. It happens. I know you've got blood at Dreng's Ferry, but then, like, kind of right from the very beginning, I won't, I'm trying not to give things away, actually, but I'll say right at the beginning, there's a scene where lots of people are in danger of becoming slaves. And there's also another thing which you mentioned, which intrigued me, which was this idea of voluntary slavery, where people might themselves, they'd be so destitute and hungry, I suppose, more than anything, that they would kneel before someone and, I suppose, volunteer themselves as slaves.
Yes, it's a very interesting phenomenon, and I haven't heard of it in any other society, in any other period of history. But the rules are laid down quite carefully in documents from the Anglo-Saxon period, and there's a little ceremony you have to go through if you offer yourself as a slave. I can easily imagine how this would come about, because anybody who is dependent on agriculture to feed themselves and their children is in a dangerous position. You only need a couple of years of bad harvests and you're hungry. And it's easy to imagine people who had not a very good farm, not very fertile land, living from hand to mouth, and when there's a couple of years of bad weather or the hay crop is washed out by summer rainstorms, you can imagine them just having no resort, no way to feed themselves. And if there was a nobleman who was willing to give them food and shelter and possibly clothing as well, in exchange for a lifetime of labour, they might have thought this is better than dying.
Mm. And therein you have a paradox, don't you, that you kind of give your life away to retain your life, but your liberty's gone, but you're still alive. And I think you have a couple of your characters discussing this at one point. And one of them is like, I would never do that. And the other one saying, well, maybe I would. I can't quite remember the scene, but I think for me, it's amplifying my understanding of this moral crime of slavery in ways that maybe I hadn't appreciated before. And I think as well, you get this later on in, for example, with the Navy of the 17th and 18th century, where people will sign away their lives to go aboard ship because they're looked after, you know, they're kind of given a rudimentary set of rations, and if they become ill, they are physicked to some level, whereas the alternative is to stay home and starve. But I think that's just a kind of a twist on a story that we're very familiar with in one sense. To be there in Bristol, to, I suppose, be at the centre of it in Britain, because you say that's the only British big slaving place, with Dublin and Rouen being the other two. There would be nowhere better, would there?
No, we certainly don't know of any other major slave markets in England. There would have been informal ones from time to time. And of course, I do describe in the evening and the morning, there is one scene that takes place at an informal slave market after the warrior chieftain comes back from battle. He brings, as they always did, he brings captured enemies to sell us, captured enemy soldiers to sell as slaves. And so I've imagined a sort of small impromptu slave market in a town. When you're making history up, you have to be very careful. And if I could just get into this time machine and go back to Bristol in 1002, I'd have all the information I needed.
Hi, I'm Artemis. You'll know me as one of the presenters on this podcast. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. Through his work, Jordan brings some of the most significant historical events and people to life, whether it's his portrait of Charles Darwin, the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, or one of my personal favourites, which is his colorization of the March on Washington in 1963. Looking at this photo, you can see hundreds of thousands of people gathered at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial who were brought to life through Jordan's colorization work. And I think we're offered a glimpse of how powerful it must have been to be a member of that crowd, about to hear one of the most famous addresses of the 20th century, which was, of course, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's almost like you are a member of the crowd yourself. All of these images and many more are available as really beautiful prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. What's more, Travels Through Time listeners get 10% off when they use the code TTT at the checkout. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colourgraph.co, and that's Colourgraph spelled C-O-L-O-R, colourgraph.co.
Let's keep this time machine going a little bit further to your second scene. And we're not going too far away. Where are we going to go to?
Exeter. Exeter was a rather wealthy town. It had a cathedral. Has a cathedral now, of course. Lovely cathedral. It's a river port. Exeter's a river port. And, you know, in some ways, being a river port is ideal because you've got navigation, but it's not quite so easy to raid and pillage a city that's up a river. And Exeter also had a wall. There's actually a bit of the wall left. If you go to Exeter, you can find this bit of construction from the old walled town. And actually, the Vikings attacked many times. They really saw Exeter as a great prize, but it was pretty well defended, maybe because they were used to being raided, I don't know. But Exeter was well defended, and there were several battles during this period, and the Vikings were beaten off several times, but in the end they took Exeter. In the end they were able to take. They weren't very good at sieges, the Vikings. They were hit-and-run types, take-the-money-and-run types. They didn't want to sit around outside the walls of a city and wait until the inhabitants starved. That wasn't their technique at all. They were fast-moving. So several times they raided at Exeter. They were driven off. And they just said, oh, the heck with it, and went around raiding surrounding villages and picking up what they could from the much less prosperous settlements all around Exeter in that part of the southwest of England. But then finally they did eventually defeat the people of Exeter, and they were able to get into the city and kill people and take slaves and, of course, take... we assume, I don't think we know the actual details, but there's no doubt that they would have taken a lot of precious ornaments from the cathedral. There would have been silver candlesticks and all of the, you know, the decorated gold and silver and jeweled boxes that were made to hold the bread for the mass, and also the relics of saints, the bones of saints, reliquaries that held these objects that were really thought of as having magical powers, certainly the power to heal and so on. Off they would go, and they would sell it somewhere else, and they would go to often France or Normandy, where they could sell this kind of stuff. I'd like to see one of those battles. The Vikings, their actual armaments were not particularly impressive. They did have helmets, we're pretty sure, although contrary to what you see in cartoons, they didn't all have horns on their helmets. That's a myth. But they did have helmets, pretty serious helmets, to protect their heads in battles, and they had axes. The most common weapon, the standard weapon for anybody going into battle, was actually a spear. With a spear, you can kill or disable somebody at something of a distance. Generally speaking, that was the favoured weapon, although people did have swords and bows and arrows and axes at the time. Most people who had a purpose-made weapon would have had a spear. And some people, I think, would not have had a purpose-made weapon. I mean, if the king raised an army from among the peasantry, he certainly, my opinion, he certainly wasn't going to give each and every one of those impecunious peasants an expensive iron sword. I imagine they would have to bring hammers, sledgehammers and scythes and so on that they normally used in agriculture. Bring those to the battle. But once again, that's something on which we don't have evidence. The battle that we have a picture of is the Battle of Hastings, but all of the participants in that are depicted as having armor and horses and purpose-made weapons. We don't see any of the riffraff, the cannon fodder, as they would have been called in a later period of history. We don't see those, unfortunately, in the biotapestry.
Yeah, what you're describing, I suppose, in a way, is a confluence of the domestic and the military, because you have the farmer swinging the scythe and someone with the spear. But more than that, it's I think the overriding sense I get from listening to you and also reading the book is that it's kind of like an Anglo-Saxon form of blitzkrieg, which the Vikings are inflicting on places. They just go so quickly, don't they? Their long boats are designed to move through the water very, very swiftly. And I mean, I suppose we can say that the book begins with a depiction of one of these raids,
which
is just happenings in lightning speed. And we wouldn't have to be there very long in Exeter to see the whole thing. Maybe this would be over the course of a few hours, and then all that would be left would be the smoke of burnt dwellings. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. I think it must have been very quick, because that was the Vikings' strength. And if that didn't work for them, if speed and surprise didn't work for them, then they really didn't have anything else. They didn't have any means of pulling down city walls, for example. That was just not part of their culture. And you're right about the boats. Those boats were remarkable, and one of the highlights of my research for the evening and the morning was visiting the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo.
Yes.
Where they have two Viking ships that are, they've been restored, but a good deal of the timbers are the original timbers. And they have them raised. Well, you can imagine, obviously, they're not in the water, so they're on a sort of wooden structure that keeps them upright. Because of that, you look up, and probably somebody sitting, on the beach or beside the river and seeing one of these emerge in the morning mist would have looked up at it as you look up at it when you walk into the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo. And it is very impressive. Yeah. They're also technically remarkable. They're narrow, they're fast. They also had a keel, which was a new thing in those days, a keel which probably most listeners will know this, but it's a flat piece of wood that sticks out of the bottom of the boat, and it keeps the boat stable. It makes it less likely to sway from side to side, rock from side to side. And it's probably why the Vikings were able to cross the North Sea. You know, crossing the North Sea in an open boat is no picnic. It's very dangerous. The North Sea has, you know, proper weather. Goodness knows how many of these Viking ships actually never made it across the North Sea, but enough of them did to cause us an awful lot of trouble. And the fact that they did, and also, you know, where they went to Greenland, and there's some evidence that they reached what is now America. So it was a remarkable technical achievement. And the boats had quite a shallow draft, or ships. They are seagoing, so we should call them ships, although they're not very big. They had a shallow draft, so they could also come up river. And the construction was quite light, so they could even, if necessary, they could be dragged onto land, and they could be dragged over shallows if necessary. They were absolutely tremendous. In other respects, the Vikings didn't have much over the Anglo-Saxons in terms of weaponry. So you're absolutely right to say surprise and speed were essential to their success.
Yeah, there's a few things here then that combine to make this a really good scene. Of course, you have the drama of the fighting and actually seeing what's, you know, kind of going on in around the dwellings and people going in and out. But also, it is the technological component of the ships, and I'd love to see that as well. The oars swinging as one as they come out of the horizon must have been an absolutely terrifying sight, and one from which you could probably not escape very easily, which is the reason why I suppose you and I have probably both got a bit of Viking blood in us today. But anyway, we can only imagine.
Well, certainly true. And I've got dark hair. Anyway, it was dark before it turned grey, and brown eyes. But yeah. When I meet somebody who has that wonderful Scandinavian blonde hair or red hair, I always think that person must have Viking DNA.
Yeah, well, you'll have to take one of those tests where you can, you know, Ancestry will tell you the whole story, maybe. But we'll leave that suspended, because it's enjoyable, really informative. But we've got one more to do before we head back, and I want to get this one in as well. So what's the third scene you would like to visit?
Well, this took place in the year 1002, and it's the wedding of the King of England, King Ethelred the Unready, as he's now called, to a Norman princess, Emma of Normandy. She was actually half Norman and half Danish, Emma. And this was a pretty big thing. You can imagine that this is not just a wedding. This is a political alliance between the two very powerful nations, the Normans and the English. I would have liked to be there. We're very vague about what happened at Anglo-Saxon weddings. They were not church affairs. At this stage, the church had not taken over the supervision of marriage. And so it was entirely a civil ceremony in which two people made legally binding promises to one another. Of course, I can imagine, and indeed there is a noble wedding in the evening and the morning. And of course, I can imagine the festivities. The vows, I think we know what they said in the vows, and they were rather short and to the point. But exactly what else went on all around the man and the woman is not always clear. And I've taken in the big wedding that takes place in the evening and the morning, I've taken everything that I could find out in the research and added quite a lot of stuff that I had to make up.
And I suppose, as it's a wedding, we should have a little glimpse at the two participants. You mentioned already Ethelred the Unready. I think that's a name which will be familiar to quite a lot of people, although I'm not sure how well he's known beyond that sobriquet. And Emma of Normandy. So what, should we start with King Ethelred to begin
yes.
with? Yeah, he's presumably got a bit of a biography that we can study.
Yes, his nickname was Unread, which means ill-advised. He wasn't unready in the modern sense of that word. You know, the nickname has sort of morphed into something that he wasn't.
So it's wasn't not in unread. The kind of Boris Johnson sense of unready. It's more.
No, he was. In fact, I've called him Ethelred the Misled.
Right.
Because unread in Old English is ill-advised.
Okay.
So I've called him Ethelred the Misled. Although, I mean, there is an argument that says he wasn't even called unread in his own time, that was a nickname that came from later historians. I'm not sure whether that's right or not, but I've called him Ethelred the Misled. He ruled for a long time. From memory, I think it was something like 40 years,
yeah.
Which in itself tells you that he wasn't incompetent. People, you know, a king, an incompetent king just didn't last that long, I don't think. Mm. He did his best in very difficult circumstances. During his reign, the Viking raids were renewed. He didn't have the talents of Alfred the Great, so he was not able to organise the defence of England against these Viking raids. Basically, the Vikings treated England as like a supermarket where you didn't have to pay. Mm. They basically showed up, took what they wanted and went off again. Ethelred wasn't able to cope with that, but then most English kings had been unable to do much about the Vikings.
Yeah. I quite like what I was just going to say, because I like the way you characterise this this problem of policy, in a way. In the book, you say, the great King Alfred chased the Vikings off, but he was the only monarch to fight back effectively. England is a rich old lady with a box full of money and no one to guard it. And that's the essential point, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. There was no... You see, there was no standing army at this time. If the king wanted to fight a battle, he had to raise an army specifically for that battle. Within the Anglo-Saxon monarchy, there were not the tools for a national defence against a national menace. He also... The king had no civil service. He had no... There were no apparatchiks. There were no... What the French call fonctionnaires. There's no civil service. So it was very difficult for him to enforce his will. Ethelred might have said, every city with a population of more than 1,000 people has to build a wall. That would have been a very sensible thing to do. He could have said it, but he couldn't have done anything about it. He couldn't have made people build walls. You know, they would all have argued about who was going to pay for it, who was going to do the work. And, of course, it most of the time it didn't get done. Although he failed, it's sort of not surprising that he failed. The other thing he did was he did pay the Vikings off a couple of times. And certainly you've got to give him credit for being able to raise money. He's a very good Chancellor of the Exchequer. He paid the Vikings, this is from memory again, but I think on one occasion £16,000 and on one occasion £24,000. Enormous sums of money.
Yeah.
Enormous sums of money at the time. Equivalent to billions today. And that in itself is something of an achievement, I think, of Ethelred's. But so I don't think he was stupid and I don't think he was useless, but he certainly failed in the primary duty of defending defending his country from invasion.
And this is where Emma of Normandy comes in, I imagine.
Yes, she was 18 in 1002. And she was at the beginning of an extremely distinguished career. She married an English king. She married Ethelred. And after Ethelred died, she married Canute. She married King Canute. So she was the wife of two English kings. And she was also the mother of Edward the Confessor. So she was the mother of one of the great English kings, the man who built the original cathedral at Westminster Abbey.
So this it's almost a bit Eleanor of Aquitaine-ish, isn't it? This idea that she's got all these connections to big history.
Yes, yes. And she survived and remained powerful over this long period of time, which in itself is an indication of great ability, I think. I mean, it was, you know, there must have been constant rivalry for the king's ear and so on, and different people, wives and concubines, all struggling to push their progeny forward. And she obviously excelled at that kind of thing, despite her youth when all this began. She obviously learned tremendously quickly and was in the end very effective. So if I was going to meet one person,
right,
in my voyage in this time machine, Emma of Normandy is the one I'd like to meet. Oh. I'd like to talk to her and you know, at this moment, the beginning of her marvellous career, I'd like to say to her, you know, what are your hopes and fears? What are you hoping to do?
There's a great opacity to these people in the sense that we don't always know what they look like. But apparently Emma's quite well represented in the visual record. Is that correct? So
Well, there are some pictures of her, but artists of this period did not really have the sense of making a likeness. They're very general. The pictures are very general. And I'm actually looking now at the cover of a biography of Emma of Normandy, which has an illustration of her. But I can't believe she actually looked like that. There's a biography called Emma the Twice Crowned Queen and by Isabella Strachan, which has been very helpful to me. But I'm afraid I don't believe Emma looked like that. Well, look, she was half Danish, half Norman. The Normans themselves basically were mostly Viking DNA, although they had become much more civilized. So if we were to guess, it's very likely that she would be light-skinned and light-haired, and she might well have had blue or green eyes.
Well, one way to solve this riddle is to send you back to the wedding, of course, and you could have a good look yourself not just at the bride and the groom, but at the ceremony and see how it all came together, because they're great unknowns, but they're completely tantalising at the same time. So we're going to step back into 2020 and leave this distant past long, long, long way away. But before we do, actually, let me ask the last question, I think. And that is, if you could bring a tangible memento back with you, maybe to have in your writing office or something, what would you bring from the year 1002?
I'm going to bring back a four-legged stool. There don't seem to have been very many, if any, regular chairs in this period. If we look at the Bayeux Tapestry, even the really important people like Duke William of Normandy and other counts, powerful people in the Bayeux Tapestry, they don't sit on any kind of throne. They sit on a four-legged stool. It's an imposing piece of furniture. It's decorated and it has cushions, so they weren't too uncomfortable. But it would have been, first of all, it would probably have been a very exquisite piece of furniture. And secondly, it would have been the seat from which justice was dispensed and laws were propounded and orders were given to men to go and do battle in various places, including Hastings. So I'd like one of those four-legged stools, and I could look at it and I could think, I wonder what evils were perpetrated by somebody sitting on that.
What a wonderful thing to have in your house. And also, if you were to do a kind of George R. R. Martin job on this, you could You could replace the Iron Throne for the four-legged chair, which sounds quite good fun as well.
Sounds
quite English, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Listen, this has not only been a really fun conversation, but I've enjoyed the book enormously as well. It really is,
great.
I think, a book which will immerse people in a period, but it's, as ever with your writing, it's the plot that's everything, isn't it? And it twists and it turns, and it's the kind of thing that will keep you going till 3 a.m. Was it a pleasure to write? Was it good fun?
Yes, I did enjoy it very much. Yes, and you're absolutely right that the you mentioned twists and turns of plots. It is important in a story like this, as far as I'm concerned, that every now and again something happens which makes the reader say, "Oh, I wasn't expecting that."
Yes, exactly. And I know from, many years ago, I read that you, this is more of a kind of writing question, but I'll get it in whilst I've got the opportunity. And I think you plot everything out quite carefully before you start the writing process, so you know exactly where you're going. Is that correct?
I do, yes. That it works for me. It doesn't work for all writers, but it certainly works for me to have a very detailed outline of the plot before I actually sit down and write chapter one.
Wow, that's a thought for people who might be thinking of the trilogy of the four-legged wooden chair. there might be a PhD student out there who's wanting to write a thesis on the underwear of the Anglo-Saxons. Who knows? Who knows? Thank you very much, Ken Follett. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Ken Follett about his new book, the prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. It's called The Evening and the Morning. It's going to be published in just a few weeks' time. Also, I have to remind you that we have this amazing competition for you. We have 2 hardback copies of The Evening and the Morning to give away exclusively to Travels Through Time listeners. To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do, this is really simple, so please go and do it. All you have to do is head to our website, tttpodcast.com, and sign up to our newsletter. As soon as you do, you'll be in the hat. Also at our website, you'll find a specific page for this episode. We've illustrated it with the very best of the images we could find, of course, and the show notes and biographies of the characters involved, and lots more as well. You can also explore a timeline on the website, which includes all of our episodes. There's almost 50 on there now. Ken is the first of our time travellers to head back to the 11th century. In fact, his nearest neighbour is Dan Jones on 1147. Of course, that's the start of the Second Crusade. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe to our feed or leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back with another adventure into the past next week, though. For me, for now, that's it. Goodbye.